I decree by the power vested in me by absolutely nobody that we will not meet in 2 weeks. Everybody's pooped, I'm pooped, and so many people have said, eh. So let me give you the dates for next year, next season. September 15th, September 29th, October 13th, October 27th, November 10th, and December 8th. Now, question. December 22nd is also Thursday, but I'm thinking that's awful close to Christmas. Want to skip that? Or that only gives us 6 classes, which is fine with me, but I thought I'd let you decide. Everyone's pretty crazy by 3 days before Christmas. Okay, so September 15th, 29th, October 13th, 27th, November 10th, and then December 8th.
Thanks for getting those dates to us. Yeah.
Well, I actually planned ahead. And thanks for your emails. I'll send those out to the class on projection.
Fall. Clean it up first.
That's fine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Did you have October 6th?
Oh,
13th.
Never mind.
13th. Did you give the dates for the
other
class?
Yeah.
It's
probably
on there.
Yeah, it's on there. Okay. Well, I have to confess this reading went over my head. This reading went over my head. So we'll try to work through it together. Some I understand, some I'm thinking, what in the world are you talking about? I think we've got to remember this is just the unconscious washing over him. So, as you know, often unconscious doesn't make sense. And it may not even make sense, but we'll do our best to try to make sense part of it. See, part of it I'm okay with. Part of it I'm flabbergasted by. Well, just a quick review. We have been talking about spirit and matter. The attempt to live by sensate pleasure versus the attempt to live spiritually above pleasure. Neither one is adequate. And what he's coming to slowly is a synthesis of the two. What's that synthesis? That synthesis is living your instinct while watching your dreams and seeing how that act actually activates the symbolic symbol creating function of the psyche, so that guidance will come to you in a way that it might not ordinarily if you don't hold yourself back from life. We ended with Gilgamesh. We talked about the story of Gilgamesh. The big thing about Gilgamesh, and that's what we'll be doing today, all day, is he starts out a victor, and he ends up defeated. Remember, he does all these battles, and then he goes for the plant of immortality, and he and gets the snake of immortality and loses it. So he goes back to his town a broken man, but more human. So by losing, he transforms into a more related human being. Now that's just the opposite of the Siegfried myth we started out with, where Siegfried means victory. And it's the attitude that dominates, that wins, that is the traditional heroic ideal. Lance Armstrong, Peyton Manning, Reggie Miller, always winning, always in charge, always prevailing. So Gilgamesh is going to be not only an answer to killing Siegfried, it's also going to be the portal for this attitude which synthesizes spirit and instinct, or spirit and matter. By spirit and matter, we mean the longing for material satisfaction.
Could we say then that he's an image of not being taken over by the archetype? Where, like, the Siegfried hero, he is the personification of the archetype.
Right.
He just lives that and is fed by that energy. And then all the projection of everyone onto that hero just flames that fire, that archetypal fire. But with Gilgamesh, the defeat, making him more human, kind of dampens down that archetypal energy that can be so destructive.
Yep, absolutely. Okay. He starts out destructive. And he ends up human, where the hero traditionally starts out weak and ends up strong. Now, if you're on the winning team, that seems like a strength. If you're on the losing team, that's felt to be destructive. Siegfried is the spirit of Germany marching across Europe. The Germans felt it as victory. Everyone else felt it as horror. So that's where we left off.
It seems like more and more today that people are being asked to live out the judgment.
I think we're being forced.
And I mean, you see a lot of the downfall, you know. Just look at the IMF guy, where...
The IMF, the banking crisis, the weather. I mean, there are plenty of ecologists who would say we're having so much upheaval in weather due to the shift in temperature of the Earth. So, and certainly I think it's pretty well understood that all the hurricanes are coming from that shift. Tornadoes, I think people would say that too. The Siegfried attitude always provokes a resentment. And it's a resentment on the part of other people, or I think we're even seeing a resentment on part of the earth. That power simply has run its course. When the world wasn't so populated and we were living in a, you know, very technically undeveloped state, Siegfried was important. Siegfried got rid of polio. You know, Siegfried got health consciousness. Siegfried got rid of despotic kings. But that power drive has reached the end of its usefulness. So I think that's why this is it's certainly about Jung personally, but it's also about a shift in our general attitude.
Well, what would you put on this shift in the, what do they call it, the Arab Spring, where the uprising of all these...
Well, remember our famous artist?
Okay.
That's the revenge of the heroic ideal. And Islam has it as bad as we do. I guess some people would say even more than we do. Absolutely. Now, all those guys were dictators. And that's Siegfried's a dictator. What's so tricky about Siegfried is that when you're in his club, it's nice. But when you're not in his club, you feel the dictatorial nature.
And so I think Obama is trying to stay in the center.
I do too.
Where he, you know, when he wasn't going to show me the picture of Ben Biden's dead and grotesque. And also he's calling for a new order in the Middle East, in Egypt and in the Middle East, where it's not necessarily they have to duplicate our form of democracy, mm-hmm. but he's hoping that they'll find their own mm-hmm. way to not be either a dictatorship nor a...
Mm-hmm.
The states of oppression...
I couldn't agree more. You know, I know you can have fault in for many things. I'm still on the side. But if you look at his style of leadership, it is very much negotiation. I don't like that he caved in on health care, but if half the country is against it, that's what a democracy is. And where, you know, Bush would have just, you know, weapons of mass destruction, carry a policy through on a lie, which is what Siegfried does. Obama is at least trying to be a different type of leader. And again, I don't agree with many of the compromises he's made, but we do live in a democracy. And if the half the country wants to blow itself up, it's their right. So I think that's something that struck me very much. He's using a different style of leadership, which is much more human. And I think it's new to our country.
Jimmy Carter,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And look how the press has both called them wussies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess there's a book coming out about his mother.
About
Obama's mother.
Yeah.
And then about some of his stuff and what he went through when he was growing up. But they made fun of him when he was in Greece with all the Russians. I guess made fun of him because of his big ears.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that his lesson was not to retaliate. And it was an eye for an eye, I guess you could call it that. You know?
Yeah.
So he learned just to shut up and just, and that would dissipate the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally stopped their behavior because he didn't provoke more of it. And so it seems like, you know, even with that example, he's trying a different way to
mm-hmm.
Deal with his enemy, so to mm-hmm. speak, or deal with the conflict. And it almost smacks of Gandhi. I mean,
mm-hmm. Gandhi would be an example of a new ideal. Absolutely. Of the Gilgamesh ideal. Martin Luther King? Definitely. Mandela? For sure. But they are certainly in the minority. And it's funny, I once talked to a CEO who said that he was determined to be, in our language, a Gilgamesh kind of CEO. And he put his office on the ground floor, had an open door policy, and drove a Honda. Everyone disrespected him. He moved his office to the top floor, got a Mercedes, paid himself a lot more, had a secretary to buffer, started getting respect. And that's also the sickness of our time. So it's not just the leader ideal has to change, but we actually want the Siegfried type of leader, even though we complain about it. So it's a huge shift going on.
And that ties in with our withdrawal of God's projection.
Absolutely.
So as Father and all yeah. benevolent and all knowing
yeah.
and
right.
solve my problems and take care of me. I mean, that withdrawal we have to do onto our leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that we can't sit back and just expect an answer.
Absolutely.
So
I think we're in a huge process of change. And, you know, if we go with the fact that this, remember, these visions were a response of the unconscious to World War I, it could be that this is the shift that has to happen to stop war. That really the very existence of our civilization depends on whether we can make this shift individually, and then whether our leaders can make it, and whether we can tolerate leaders that don't dictate answers. Sometimes I'm optimistic, sometimes I'm not. Okay, so we talked about Gilgamesh, and then we'll start now with page 277. He is climbing into desolate mountain range. Yeah, that's pretty much that page. Well, we just started.
Oh, I see. First day. Okay.
And he sees an enormous man approach him. Second paragraph, 278. The giant is carrying a sparkling double axe in his hand, like those used to strike bulls. And it's Izdubar, which is Gilgamesh. He's Izdubar. That's the name of the guy. But that's another name for Gilgamesh.
Now
it gets hard. So we'll go slowly. And I'll try to make sense of it as we go along, and then it even gets worse with Jung's commentary. And we'll try to figure it out. And I will be open to your ideas. I do not pretend to understand everything here.
I think it's important to mention that Gilgamesh is trembling with fear. Someone so large and mighty.
Keep going. Interpret that now.
Fearful. Well, because he's lost in the past, is he fearful of losing again?
I think it's a healthy image that this hero isn't estranged from fear.
Okay, so he's in touch with his instinct.
And his vulnerability.
Okay.
See, Siegfried would never show fear. You know, remember, I mean, if you're ever unclear about Siegfried, that's Hitler. And remember when the troops were caught in Russia, and the Germans invaded, and then the winter set in, and they all froze to death, literally froze to death? He would say, don't be afraid. This is the hour of your greatest triumph. You will triumph. See, that's Siegfried. Where a human reaction would say, get the hell out of here before we freeze to death. And they did freeze to death. They had no winter coats. And it didn't bother. Hitler would not take that into account. So that, well, that's an extreme, but those of you who have been in industry, how often do they say, what do you feel like doing? It's all willpower, driving, planning, and willpower. And it doesn't take account of the complexity of the people involved, nor the consequences.
And it doesn't take, you know, reality.
Yeah.
So marketing, I know it's in marketing for sales. You know, okay, let's just set these arbitrary goals. No, we've got the market reality. Really is what, you know,
or the ability of the people to meet them.
You know, but just even how many accounts are out there that are feasible to even sell to. And yeah, in this regard, it's almost as if they are the part of them that is repressed so deeply.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way. The doubt that we talked about?
Yeah. See, doubt and fear doesn't exist.
Yeah. And the healthy doubt.
The limitations.
Right.
Every meeting I go to, it's like, okay, you're adding this, what are you taking away? Because we're working 12-hour shifts with no lunch.
Yeah. That's
while you're charting, which legally you can't because, you know, you've got specimens and stuff that's on those counters, you're not supposed to be eating them. Mm-hmm. But you have, if you want any lunch, you're eating at the grocery station because there is no time. And they keep adding and adding. And
that's sacred. Yeah. He's pervasive.
Take care of sick people.
Yeah.
You know,
he's mentally ill.
At least he's got cardiac therapy. You know, I've got the mentally ill. And who's the most mentally ill here?
With all relative.
Yeah.
I think I told you that little theater group I volunteered for, they did that play and collected dreams just from the public to make a short play about from dream themes, and half the dreams they collected from the general public were about unhappy animals. The Siegfried just runs right over instinct. So it's pervasive, and it exists in degrees.
Gary, can we go back 1 minute to 277?
Yeah.
It struck me when we were talking about the fact that they were in a mountain range.
Yeah.
That would be up too high.
Yes.
Mountain thickness, something. I don't know. That thought popped into my head.
Yes, definitely. Well, let me anticipate then where I think I would go to interpret what we're going to see. Gilgamesh is the self. Jung is the ego. This is how I try to make sense out of it. It's simply an opinion, and you're free to come up with your own ideas. But the nature of the unconscious self is it's bigger than life, and it's inflated. The nature of making the self conscious is the self actually descends. You see it in dreams as dreams of coming down. And paradoxically, even though the ego is getting stronger, you often see dreams of the ego being poisoned. Because the ego ideas are buffeted by the new ideas that are coming in from the self. So that the effect on the ego of growth is actually confusion for a while. So these two systems, I am trying to understand this passage as the foundation of, remember this is way before Jung has any of these ideas, the foundation of Jung's idea of the interaction between ego and self. And, so that's why it's high. Now, I was trying to think of an example. Remember the story I told you about the opera singer fellow? Yeah, he had graduated from IU in the classical opera. And the dream he had, which struck me so powerfully, was he went into a church and all the pews were turned with their back to the altar. And so the altar would be the self, the genuine potential that he has as an opera singer. And that showed me that he was turning his back to his genuine potential, which is very serious if you've got a lot of good potential. It's not so serious if you're a doofus, like most of us, but if you are that gifted, and you could just tell he had an enormous gift, just in his voice, just speaking, it resonated. Now, what he said was, chicks don't like starving artists. Which is probably true. I said, well, a lot of chicks don't, but you only need one. That didn't sink. Well, good. I couldn't convince him of that, but I could at least get him thinking one. But now let's take that in terms of this. See, the potential to be an opera singer would be Izdebar. Why did he not want to realize his operatic talents? Because that would mean taking that potential down into reality and living with all the mundane consequences of performing in Timbuktu or some small stage before he could work his way up. See, so that's the sense that when the self is made conscious, there's a coming down. That's how I've tried to understand the height and this business, which gets very confusing, about lamed and blind.
So when you realize the enormity of the task and your responsibility, that's a coming down.
That's a coming down, and living with, you know, it means getting up at 5 o'clock to put on makeup. It means all the hassles of daily life you have to take on, and all the performances that you might flub. He was a good singer in potential, and I'm sure in practice, but he would have had to go through many moments of feeling he made a mistake, or there was a failure, a bad performance, or he was in a bad mood, or he was sick and didn't feel like, you know, singing. That's all the coming down. So we talk about realizing the self is this, oh, it's this great blossoming and unfolding. It's a huge pain in the butt. That's why people resist it so much. The ideal of what you can do is always less than what it feels like to have fulfilled it. Once you've fulfilled it, it will then feel important when you see the beauty of what you've done. But even by comparison, always what you could have been seems bigger.
It makes sense with the pictures, because the original pictures of the flowers we decided were medicines and poisons.
Now, I just saw a dream of somebody last week who is also has a gift and is going about realizing it, and what he dreamt was being bitten in the right hand by a poisonous snake. Because the shift that's required of the ego by the self is felt to the ego initially as a poisoning of the ego. You may get depressed, you get listless, you feel confused, you think you had things straightened out, and what you believed in before you no longer believe in. So in the case like what you said, Anne, for that opera singer, it would have been the shift in realizing, look, there are lots of women out there who would die to share your life with you. And to make that shift would have been for him to feel he was being poisoned.
They weren't the women he wanted at that moment.
Or they weren't the race queens or whatever he was chasing. Yeah. Pardon?
If he picked one,
and if he picked one, he had to give up all the rest of them.
And even just to memorize an opera, it takes an enormous amount of time, so there's no time to actually chase them.
Seems like the Mary story is such a parallel about that. I mean, that she didn't get poisoned, but she got, you know, an impregnation, and then she didn't really probably want it. And then it was a social.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Lesson. And you know the theological word for that event? Kenosis? You know that word? It means emptying. In the Bible, don't ask me where. It said that God emptied himself into her. So there again you get the idea that making the potential, the divine potential, I say divine because it's so special, potential real, is an experience of being emptied. There's not much in the Bible I like. I love that part. Yeah, I think it's Kenosis. It's called, in theology, they talk about the kenosis.
K-E-N-O-S-I-S.
I love that, and I love Jacob and the angel. Really, because both of them show that growth is a loss. Remember, Jacob got his hip busted wrestling with the angel. And I think he'll allude to that here. Same idea that the encounter with the divine is an injury. Because, first of all, it's so damn strong, it generally comes along and bashes you over the head in, you know, a failed marriage, a unhappy child, bankruptcy, legal troubles, things like that. That's how the self often enters in. That's how it starts. Of course, the end product is quite beautiful. But we very conveniently forget all the misery along the way. in our, you know, seven habits of highly effective Jungian talks. I think I should give a talk. The seven miseries of highly effective Jungians.
That would be more true.
Here, Gilgamesh is the one that's afraid. So as the divine comes to us, not only does the evil thing come, but it's also affecting the divine.
Absolutely.
In the way that it's here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's different entirely.
Yeah.
That's
the answer to Job. That's why Job actually confronts the divine, and the divine changes. Yeah.
The divine has to change too.
Yeah.
Rather than the old idea that the divine is the divine.
The divine can be fearful or it can be rageful. And that doesn't fit our traditional picture of old man in the sky.
Reason the divine that used to be seen as incarnated as the king.
Yeah.
And now in the president of the United States, the picture that just keeps coming back to me is about him being afraid was a still picture that was taken in some little room, not any bigger than this probably. When Obama gave the order to go forward, Obama, yeah. And he's not sitting at the table in a suit with people surrounding him.
Mm-hmm.
He's sitting on this stool. I mean, there are other people, and he's crouched over like this. It's like almost like, oh my God, can
mm-hmm.
I do this? You know, it was an amazing photo.
Mm-hmm.
It was,
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
He wasn't a big guy. He was just
mm-hmm.
one of. He was part of the group, you know, which I think is how he likes to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He was trying to help his people in the process, in Chicago, and he thought, well, I don't have enough power because I'm not a warrior, and, you know. I mean, it just seemed like a whole progression. If I'm going to do anything I want to do, I got to keep.
Well, like the
officer,
needed to go.
Okay, so I think if you keep that as examples in mind, it may help understand some of this stuff. Again, what we'll see is the irony is that even sometimes poisoning is a negative thing. In dreams, sometimes it's a positive thing. We'll talk a lot about poison, and he seems to be equivocating about whether it's a good or bad thing, and that's, I think, the foundation of that idea. So that fellow who had the poisonous, the dream of the poisonous snake biting his hand, felt, oh my God, that's a bad dream, what am I doing wrong? I say, no, it shows that you're letting the different point of view of the unconscious work on you, and it's confusing and painful. Okay, so, right after the break on first column on 278. I'll just try to hit the main points. Isdabar says, you come from the West. And yes, he said, yes, does the sun sink in that sea? Why is that important? See where we are? Kind of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 lines after the break. Does the sun sink in that sea?
Does that have to do with the thing about the sun rising and then it dies? And
yes. And where I go with it is, Isdabar is the sun. And sinking into the sea means making the potential of the self real. So that's an image of descent. So by the dialogue starting out with the sun sinking, we're alerted to the fact that this is a descent. In alchemy, that descent is called a coagulatio. Do you know that word?
What?
Is that right? Coagulatio, yeah.
It's the Latin for coagulation. You know, chemistry, when things coagulate, they come together. And so the coagulatio was, in their mind, when the pieces that were chopped up in the primer first material recombined. And one of the ways that recombining was symbolized in alchemy was coming down. So these coming down themes are about, often about potential becoming real, fantasies becoming real, talent becoming real.
It's usually when something coagulates, say when blood does, the things that are heaviest that come together, the cells that will join together will fall to the bottom.
Okay? With me so far? It gets worse. So the sun sinks, blah, 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 blah. Then Isdabar says, a little further down there, damn one, where did you get such knowledge? And then Jung says, oh, Isdabar, most powerful one, see where I am? I come from a land where this is proven science. Now that's the big word. So what we're going to be looking at is the role of reason in this process of the self becoming real. On the one hand, you can see this whole process doesn't fit in the framework of science. There's nothing we can scientifically prove about the self becoming real. It's not amenable to scientific experiment because it's always an individual process with individual variation. On the other hand, we also can't abandon reason. Because the way the self often strikes us is in these overpowering emotions, which we have to be able to discern reasonably. And just look at the role of reason in my comment to that fella about the snake bite. I had to use reason to explain why that was a good thing. So we get a new factor in here. Unconscious self inflated, ego, that the descent of one is the wounding of the other, and the paradoxical role of reason. I think that's what he's wrestling with. And what this is going to come out with in Jungian psychology is all of these belong together.
So that would be the importance of the ego and consciousness in differentiating.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. You know, somebody comes in and says, well, you know, I met the other woman. I'm thinking about having an affair. Does your wife know? No. Okay, let's talk about this. You know, putting it reasonably to them, okay, if you're going to have this affair, do you want to risk your marriage? And should you discuss it? You see, looking at all the practical things, or maybe, are you sure this woman is who you think she is? Maybe she's just seducing you. Maybe she'd like a divorce so she can get your money. Who knows? But that's where reason is so important when we're in an emotional storm. On the other hand, he might say, well, you know, I'm ready to jump off a bridge. Life has become so unbearable. I'm going to do this even though it's unreasonable, even though it may cost me my marriage. So we have to use reason to know when to give up reason. So, next, Gilgamesh smashes his axe. Bottom of the page. Because power now is out of the question. What we're doing is trying to hear what does the psyche want, not what do we want. Our opera singer did not want to be an opera singer. He wanted to go to law school, make money, so he could get the chicks. That would be his double axe. That's the sacrifice. And we go, okay, so far? We go over to 278, go down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 lines. Izdubar says, miserable worm, where did you suckle on this poison? See where I am? What's that poison?
Is he saying that reason is poison?
For him, reason is felt as poison.
For Jung?
For Izdubar, for the self. Because the self will often, as I said, start as an overpowering sexual desire or hatred. Either a very positive instinctual experience or a very negative instinctual experience. And it feels like you should act on the state of mind. You know, the guy who shot Gifford and so on. I know he's schizophrenic, but that's the kind of rage that often overtakes people. And I've got to quit this job. I've got to move to another city. Some violent resentment against the way things are. I got to get rid of this wife. You know, I got to heck with my child support, you know, and so on. And what we have to do is say, that is not to be taken as a primary experience, as the final experience, might be a better way to say it. But it's got a self-image embodied in it. And if you can endure that, then you will get the self-image out of it. So holding our own against the impulsion that the self enters in is felt by the self as poison.
Our resistance or our holding your own, that's felt by the self as poison.
Yes.
Because
it, when it first, I mean, I think it can appear directly as a image of resolution and quite bestowing a sense of peace and knowledge, oh, this is the way I should go now. But very often it starts as a huge emotional upset.
Well,
I'm just trying to understand if the self thinks that's poison, are not giving in to that impulse. The self thinks that's poison.
Right.
Then, okay, so this is the psyche's way of conflict, using conflict to make us become more.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So, okay. But it doesn't like our resistance.
No, it does not. Well, it's a trick. It doesn't like anything. If it doesn't like our resistance, if you give in to it, and you get into a mess, it'll say, "Where are you, stupid?" There was a wonderful play this little theater group I was telling you about did. It really should be like a national play, and I am sad they didn't take it further. Called the Love Song of J. Robert Oppenheimer, and they performed it here, I don't know, a year or two ago. And it's written by a little-known, I don't think they like this word, upcoming playwright, but it's a dialogue between Oppenheimer, you know, the guy who made the bomb, and Lilith.
No.
It's an imagined dialogue. And in the play, Lilith says to Oppenheimer, "Now, go make this bomb." That's the first half of the play. Second half of the play, she says, "You idiot, why'd you make that bomb?" That's the way the unconscious self works. It's terribly confusing. And I think part of the art of our work is knowing when do you listen to it on its own terms, when do you frustrate it and insist that it shows you a different face. It's a very difficult thing. I think with younger people you can pretty much say, "Oh, go for it." What if you got married, you got a house, you've worked all your life for a professional reputation? The ante is up.
That does explain why, it helps me understand why Yahweh was so angry at Job for holding firm.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not giving in to him. I mean, it really pushed him back on his own. With his own mirror.
Absolutely.
And that just helps explain why he was so angry. And he kept getting angry at him, even after he didn't really come back and, you know, cuss him out or anything, but he was still getting angry at him.
Absolutely. That's the nature of the unconscious self. That it is, as Jung says, a mixture of opposites. If I ask you to do something, you do it, it'll condemn you for doing it. And that is what, I think, what Jung is starting, I don't know if he's starting to realize it, but that these are the reflections that Jung then brought back to this material to understand the paradoxical nature of the unconscious self. On the one hand, how dangerous it is, and on the other hand, you know, like that guy, that opera singer who was arrested for 3 counts of attempted murder. See, that's the self. That's how dangerous this thing is.
It's all these politicians.
And the guys who fall from grace, yeah.
I mean, it really accentuates our need to stand up to authority figures and really question their judgment.
Mm-hmm. I actually stand up to anything. We'll see later. He talks about falling into the hands of God. That would be simply acting out the emotional intensity that is activated when you do confront an inner or outer authority figure. And I didn't have time to find the actual text, but there's a wonderful dream Jung tells of, I think he was later in his life, of being in front of Akbar the Great. My Near Eastern history is a little weak. He was either an Indian or Near Eastern king, let's say. And in the dream, Jung is to kneel before him. And he does, but he refuses to touch his forehead to the ground. He leaves a millimeter. And he said, that is the freedom we must always maintain. Apropos these experiences. We have to submit to them, but never give up our reason in the submission. And again, I think he got that sort of thought out of this text. That's how I'm understanding it, anyway.
And he said just acting out our impulses is falling into the hands of God.
Well, we'll get there eventually, yeah. It's falling in, I forget how he puts it.
It's down, okay, that's right. We'll get to it.
Yeah. I forget exactly because we'll get there eventually. Oh, yeah, here it is. Page 281. The last paragraph on the first column. Consequently, they fell into the hands of the living God and learned to kneel and to lie with their faces down to beg for pity. And then top of 281, only your fearful cry can stop the God. The God is afraid of man.
I mean, you're saying stand up to almost anything, but really when it ultimately it comes down to the God in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Either whether it hits you from the inside or whether you meet it in a projected state. Yep.
But what we are taught is that God is all-knowing.
Yep.
And so you have to unlearn that.
You have to unlearn that.
In order to do this. And I think what he shows us here is dialoguing. He never stops the dialogue with his figures,
yeah.
Questioning
yeah.
What are you about? Who are you about? What is it that you want?
Mm-hmm. And this highly ambivalent thing when you meet the self, that it is overpowering, potentially destructive, potentially very creative. It's all of the above. I don't think it's quite as far into Judaism as it is to Christianity, because you've got Jacob wrestling with the angel. He didn't. And the angel tried to destroy him. And then when he didn't let the angel destroy him, the angel changed his name to Israel. Jacob, that was the beginning of Israel. Jacob's name was changed after not letting the angel destroy him. So if he let the angel destroy him, he would have become Israel. If he hadn't fought the angel, he wouldn't have become Israel. It's really a remarkable image. I think one we have to keep in mind in our inner work all the time. Okay, so that's the poison. Maybe it's time for a break.